The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, on Christmas Eve, NASA's Parker Solar Probe will make the closest approach to the sun ever. We'll learn about the science behind the mission. And the Fish and Wildlife Service wants to place the monarch butterfly on the endangered species list. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. It has been quite the year for our sun. The total eclipse, solar storms, some once-in-a-lifetime moments for millions. On Christmas Eve, NASA's Parker Solar Probe will make the closest approach to the sun ever. Dr. Noura Rouafi is an astrophysicist and the project scientist for the Parker Solar Probe mission, which launched in 2018. He spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds about the solar flyby.
On Christmas Eve of 2024, this year, Parker Solar Probe will be making history, and it will be only 3.8 million miles from the surface of the sun. That number might sound a large number, but it's only about 4% of the sun-Earth distance. Parker Solar Probe will be flying through the structure that we see during total solar eclipses, and flying through this medium is teaching us so much about the sun, how it works, and how it can affect us through its activity.
So a question I immediately thought of was, how is this solar probe, Parker, not going to melt? I mean, we know that the sun is very hot. So just how hot is the sun, and how is the spacecraft Parker made and built to withstand this sort of intense heat and even the radiation that the sun emits?
The environment that Parker Solar Probe flies through when it is close to the sun is extremely harsh. The amount of heat that it receives from the sun is about 500 times the hottest summer day we witness here on Earth. That is extremely hot. And there, then you have to protect your spacecraft at all times. And to do this with Parker Solar Probe, we have a heat shield that is standing between the sun and the probe itself. On Christmas Eve, when Parker Solar Probe is closest to the sun, the heat shield side facing the sun will be glowing at about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. About a yard behind, it will be almost room temperature. And that is kind of magic. That's actually where most of the instrumentation of the body of the spacecraft resides. So we have been waiting for over 60 years for the technology to catch up with our needs to fly a spacecraft in a safely manner very close to a star. And thanks to this heat shield, that is basically a piece of carbon foam. But it's so efficient, it dissipates heat like no other material, which is fascinating.
So the sun is a star we've always known, and it is a constant in our lives. And I feel like we do know a lot, but I also feel there's a lot that we don't know. So what do we hope to learn with Parker?
When we built Parker Solar Probe, we have three big phenomena that has been puzzling scientists for decades. The first one is when you look at the corona, that is the outermost layer of the solar atmosphere, is over 300 times hotter than the solar surface. Which is counterintuitive. In principle, it should get cooler, but it does not. And this boiling gas cannot stay static, and therefore it generates a flow of particles that are electrons, protons, and heavy ions that fill the whole heliosphere. And the fascinating thing about this flow that we call the solar wind is that particles get accelerated to hundreds of kilometers per second over a very short distance. And the mystery, we don't know where do they get the energy from. You add to that, the sun is obviously a magnetized star, and it's very active. And every now and then, there are these big explosions like flares and coronal mass ejections. They accelerate particles to almost the speed of light. And these particles are a hazard for humans in space, for space equipment like GPS and telecommunication satellites. And they can affect us here on the ground as well. And that's basically what we built Parker Solar Probe for. But we are flying through a region of space that we never visited before. And any measurements is a potential discovery, and that's exactly what we are learning from the data. And that's what makes Parker Solar Probe an exploration mission by excellence. We are learning so much about the sun. There are certain phenomena that we discovered with Parker Solar Probe that we didn't even know before.
So where exactly is Parker passing through with the sun, and what is the importance of having Parker make the approach during a time when the sun is especially active?
So Parker Solar Probe will be flying through the solar corona that we saw on the eclipse of April 8th of this year. The structure that we saw there, Parker Solar Probe will be flying through them. And the reason we wanted to fly it that close is we have been observing the sun for decades now. And we made all sorts of observation about the sun, but we couldn't really get much insight into what causes these big mysteries that we talked about before. To do it, we need to get very close to the sun to make local measurements there to tell us what are the physical processes that are driving this phenomena there.
So now knowing where exactly Parker will be passing through, which, by the way, if you were in the path of totality when the eclipse occurred earlier this year, you were able to see that outer rim of the sun with your very own eyes. And we know there was a lot of ground observations made by citizens and even by NASA. So how are those ground observations that were made and the observations that Parker will be making inform each other?
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. During the total solar eclipse, Parker Solar Probe was very close to the sun, along with Solar Orbiter, the ESA NASA mission as well. And there are many other missions that were observing the sun from space and many, many, many ground observatories. And we also have, along the line of the path of totality, a myriad of smaller instruments that observe the sun. So collectively, these data sets will help us build the big picture about the solar corona and all the activities that goes on with there. Some of the data has been already looked at. Some other data is being analyzed now, and we are already learned a few things from the eclipse. But there are many, many things that we have to learn from the data we already gathered.
So going along with the sun's activity, it seems to be quite active this year with the eclipse that we were just talking about, the powerful solar storms, and even these auroras that were occurring even here on the East Coast, sometimes even in our backyards. So what sort of information will Parker study to get to the root cause of why there has been so much activity recently with the sun?
So we launched Parker Solar Probe in 2018. Back then, the sun was very quiet. We were at the minimum of the solar cycle. But over time, over the past 6 years, the activity on the sun built up to the solar maximum that we are living now. And it's now that the sun is so active. Parker Solar Probe flew through so many of these coronal mass ejections and gave us insights into how they affect the medium they fly through and how the shock waves that are driven by this coronal mass ejection accelerates particles to almost the speed of light. But obviously, we need more observation when Parker Solar Probe is close by. We need to gather more data of that sort to build a statistically significant sample that we can build, analyze, and help the models to understand how the acceleration of particles is done.
We know this is an interesting time to study the star during a time where it is more active than it usually is. So what plan does NASA have to explore the sun in the future?
We just have the decadal survey published the week before last. And one of the recommendations is a solar polar mission. There is one place we observed the sun for decades and decades, maybe even centuries. But we have been always observing the sun from the ecliptic. The poles of the sun, we never observed them directly. But this decadal recommended a flagship mission that will fly above the solar poles over many, many years to help us understand what is going on there. And the importance of the solar poles is basically if we get insights how the flows are and the magnetic fields behave there, that will help us understand how the solar cycle comes by and also potentially predict it in the future, how much the sun is going to be active in the next solar cycle and the cycle after that.
The Parker Solar Probe will pass the planet Venus on its flight to the sun. What is the importance of that to the study?
So we use Venus to get closer to the sun. Every time we fly by Venus, the spacecraft will lose a tiny bit of speed, and as it slows down, it will dive closer to the sun. So we did see seven Venus gravity assists. The last one was in November of this year. And that's actually what sets us to this closest approach on December 24, 2024. But talking about Venus, every time we fly by Venus, we turn all our instruments on and trying to study the Venus and the atmosphere of the planet. And guess what? Parker Solar Probe made key discoveries about Venus itself. One of the big discoveries that Parker Solar Probe made is the discovery of a new window to study the surface of Venus at 0.75 micron. That has never been observed before. And basically what Parker Solar Probe is giving us is a new wavelength band to look at the solar surface and get insights into it. And this actually new discovery is going to be exploited by missions dedicated to Venus in the future.
Dr. Noor Rawafi is an astrophysicist and project scientist for NASA's Parker Solar Probe mission. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing Endangered Species Act protection for the monarch butterfly. The iconic migratory butterfly with its orange wings and colorful caterpillars that are a staple of elementary school science classrooms are in decline. The Fish and Wildlife Service is now accepting public comments on its proposal to list the species as threatened. To learn more, I spoke with the Fish and Wildlife Service's Julie Slacom, division chief at the agency's Chesapeake Bay Field Office in Annapolis, Maryland.
I think in the past, you know, it was actually a very common species. So I think those of us that are middle-aged, you know, we grew up playing in the summer outside most of the time. And, you know, you would see monarchs flying around. So, you know, I think it's a species that brings nostalgia to a lot of us, but also it's a species that, you know, it has unique markings, you know, it has beautiful coloring, you know, so when people see it out in nature, you know, they recognize it, you know, and it's a special experience seeing them flying around.
So why is the monarch butterfly threatened, and why is the Fish and Wildlife Service seeking protections for the monarch butterfly?
Yeah, so, you know, we've been monitoring this species for decades, and, you know, since the mid-1990s, we've been seeing a decline in the population. So this is a species where we have really good data. We don't always have that for other species. And the way that we look at the numbers is we look at when they're overwintering. So for the eastern North American population, that population overwinters in Mexico. So essentially, you know, we count the numbers when they're in Mexico in the winter. But for the eastern population, those numbers have declined by 80% since the mid-1990s. So when you see a trend like that, it's, you know, you have to take a pause and wonder, you know, if it keeps declining this significantly, you know, are we going to lose the species, you know, in the near future? So it really is about that declining trend over time and that large number, you know, decreasing by 80%. And I think that number is even larger for the Western population.
What's contributing to that decline? Is it habitat loss? Is it climate change? What's leading to these shrinking numbers?
So I feel like I tell the same story for a lot of the species that we propose for listing. It really is about habitat loss and degradation. I think that's one of the biggest threats. But there's also, you know, it's an insect. So exposure to insecticides, herbicides, the herbicides impacting the, you know, the host plant that they rely on to lay their eggs and for the larvae. But it is also changes in our climate. They're very sensitive to, you know, changes in temperature and precipitation. And you're seeing in a lot of our, you know, if you just think about the eastern U.S., you know, the southern states, you know, you see there being higher temperatures, you know, very high temperatures during the summer. You're seeing more droughts and you're seeing more severe weather events. So given that they're so sensitive to those weather events, you know, it can wipe, one weather event could wipe out, you know, a population of monarchs. So it's really important that we have populations spread out across the country to help deal with these threats.
And I think a lot of people are familiar with where the monarch lays its eggs and where caterpillars are found, and that's on milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Fish and Wildlife Service have any materials or educate people about how they can create habitat for monarch butterflies in their backyards?
Yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, we have, you know, worked with nonprofits and communities and through our refuge system to educate people. We have really good nonprofit partners that are doing the same. But I think to be able to, you know, and I guess I should say we haven't made a listing decision. This is a proposed, you know, rule to list the species. But if we do come out with a final rule to list the species, you know, we're gonna have to up our game to work even harder, you know, with our federal partners on our refuges, on national parks, you know, with educating just landowners how they can plant milkweed in you know, in their backyard, in their gardens, because every little bit of habitat is going to count. But we've got to up our game and continue to educate and try to get as much habitat on the ground as we can.
How important is that public support when it comes to establishing Endangered Species Act protections for a particular animal?
I think, you know, we can't recover these species without public support. You know, this is a species that uses habitat, you know, milkweed, you know, throughout the nation. And, you know, so it's not just on federal or state land. You know, you can grow milkweed in your backyard. So to have, like, you know, connected habitat at that larger landscape level, we definitely need to involve the public. And luckily, I feel like the public wants to help us. You know, they love the species. They don't want to see an iconic species like the monarch. You know, they don't want that. They don't want the species to disappear in the future.
Julie Slacom is Division Chief at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Chesapeake Bay Field Office in Annapolis, Maryland. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard.